This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. For couples trying to start a family, reading a pregnancy test is an emotional moment. So imagine a cameraman filming it.
That's positive.
Oh, my God, I'm pregnant.
I didn't think it would be. I want to be my number.
Oh, my God. You're pregnant. What do you think?
I'm pregnant. Maria.
Oh, yes, it's amazing.
Oh, my God. I'm not even fatigued.
Well, that is exactly how Mel and Carrie Downey Piper experienced it. We know because it's on film. The couple asked their film student neighbor to be their sperm donor. He agreed, but asked to make a documentary about the process. The result is Between Friends and Family. It's about a relationship among the three and the process of starting a family. Rick Dilwood is a filmmaker and film professor at University of North Carolina, Greensboro, and he joins us now. Welcome, Rick. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also on the program, Carrie Downey Piper, Rick's neighbor and one of the mothers of two children, Logan and Dylan. Welcome, Carrie. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the background about this, you and Mel, and your decision to have children.
Well, we always knew we wanted to have children, but it was a progression trying to figure out how we would go about doing that. At first, we thought we would use a sperm bank, and the more we thought about it and looked into it, we thought, you know, why not ask somebody that we know? So we started doing that, and we ended up with Rick, and we were really happy with that decision.
Well, along the way, there were some complications just in the thought process, because once you decide to go with somebody you know, how well you know them became kind of an issue, right?
It did, yes. We didn't want them to be super close to us because we wanted there to be a boundary. We didn't want a third parent involved. So at first we thought, well, it would be ideal if it was a friend of a friend, somebody that we knew we could trust because we trust our friends. So we wanted a little bit of a disconnect there.
Rick, how did you come to know Carrie and Mel?
Actually, I was living in Durham at the time, and I lived in a neighborhood that Mel and Carrie moved into. And so I was a part of the neighborhood association. So I knew them casually from those kinds of functions of just like block parties. And I think there was maybe a neighborhood dinner or something, and just kind of inviting new neighbors to the block. And so I think before they asked me, we'd maybe hung out like four or five times. It wasn't so we were acquaintances, I guess, at that point.
So that makes in that way, that makes Rick a kind of perfect candidate, right? He's somebody you kind of know.
Right.
All right. So how did his name then enter the mix and he become the man who did donate the sperm to your family?
Well, as Rick said, we had some functions in the neighborhood and there was a holiday party where we were speaking with his wife at the time and talking about having the process of trying to find a donor and how hard it was. We had asked a few people and had been told no several times. And actually, his wife said, well, I'd volunteer my husband, but I don't know how he'd feel. And that night she asked him. And the next day he emailed us and said, hey, tell me more about this.
Yeah, I didn't agree to it right away. I just asked for more information. Because
I want to know about the conversation between you and your wife that night when she said, Rick, I've got this idea.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, we left a holiday party, which was like right across the street. And she told me that it had come up in conversation and that she kind of threw my name out there. And so I thought, I was pretty surprised. I don't think I'd ever really considered that situation at all of being a known donor for somebody where, I sort of knew sperm banks existed. But So I sort of thought about it and I was curious enough to ask for more information, but I was really careful not to commit to anything at that point. I just wanted to know, like, what are the logistics of this and how does this exactly all happen?
I wonder what the thought process are. I mean, as you think about the implications and the potential complications, what were they? Did they occur to you right away?
Well, I mean, I did as much, Googling as I could at first, and I talked to a lot of people that I knew at the time just to sort of like practice that conversation a little bit, just talk through, like get people's reactions. What would you do in this situation? And I was aware that there were, potentially some legal risks involved. I think that there was some instances of people where if Mel and Carrie had their kids and then later wanted me to pay child support or something like that, there was some financial risk, but those all seemed pretty unlikely. Just given that, the whole idea was that I would sort of have a distance from their family. So And then it, you know, then it all sort of boiled down to this issue of, you know, if you have the means to help somebody, then you should. So I couldn't find any good reasons not to do it. And so then we just proceeded from there.
The bigger risk, I guess, Carrie, is for you and Mel, the idea, and this has happened, where a sperm donor agrees to relinquish all responsibility and any claim to the child and then later changes their mind.
Yes, and we did have that fear. We drew up a contract, a donor agreement with Rick, and he basically signed off saying that he wouldn't try to steal our babies. But it hasn't been an issue. I mean, we had one very intense conversation with Rick, which I'm sure you remember, where we were talking about whether he should film the ultrasound or not. And at that point, we had some fear that he might feel attached to the child if he saw the child on the ultrasound screen. So we did some grilling of him ahead of time to make sure that he wasn't going to feel that way.
Because I had asked to go to film it because I needed the scene for the documentary that I was working on.
Well, so I want to get into the documentary and, again, sort of why you would even agree to this. But I want to go back to something you said about all of those potential sperm donors who'd said no, who turned you down. Why did they turn you down?
Well, some of them had previously said yes. You know, they had said to us, you know, if you ever get to a point that you want to have children, please keep me in mind. So when we went to those people, they thought about it and they said, you know, I know I said that, but I can't. For some of them, it was that they were in a new relationship and thinking of getting married and thinking of having their own kids. So they didn't really know how they felt about that. And another instance, it was that the wife wasn't comfortable with it. And another guy, he just felt like he didn't want the responsibility of the possibility of one day an 18-year-old showing up at his door.
Yeah, it's an awful lot to think about. So now the decision. So Rick is a willing donor. He says if you have the means to help somebody, you should. And he's a filmmaker. And he says, oh, by the way, I'd like to document this whole thing. How'd you feel about that when he suggested it?
Well, you know, if somebody would have told me then how big this would have gotten, I would have said no way. I mean, anybody who knows me, I'm a pretty private person. But at the time, it was a slow evolution. And he said he wanted to make this short documentary for his school project. And I thought, okay, so there's probably going to be maybe 20 film students and a professor watching it. So, okay, why not? And then it just got bigger and bigger. And
well, tell us about the gestation of the film, if you will. It did start out as just a school project and kind of grew. Tell us how that evolved.
Yeah, I mean, when I got asked to be a donor, I was already enrolled in a documentary production class. So I sort of knew that I needed some project. And then as I was looking forward to starting that class, I was having this conversation all the time with everybody about, like, people ask me to do this thing. What do you think about this thing? And it just, there was a lot of interest in that. Like, everybody wanted to talk to me about it. So it just seemed like silly to pass up that opportunity that I'm sitting on this subject that has a lot of potential. But at that point, I had no delusions that I was ever going to make something that would play at a film festival or that would be at all interesting to anyone beyond people I already know. So yeah, it started out as like a 9-minute project. And then once I was done, people were responding to it in a way that, like, even my professor said, like, I think you could submit this. And it like blew my mind. I had no idea that was.
But you did have to expand it from that point, right?
Well, the 9-minute version I submitted, I had in festivals for about a year. And then my program was 3 years. So I needed a thesis project also, which was meant to be longer. So there didn't seem any reason to, like, stop working on it. So then we negotiated that of, like, what that would look like to shoot more footage. And, you know, I made that version. And then that version became Between Friends and Family.
One of the interesting conflicts, and I think the most poignant throughout the film, Rick, is your struggle with what your role should be and where, how these boundaries would be set and where.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was part of the thing about continuing the project is that I had no references for how this could go. Like, you know, there just aren't a lot of narratives out there or, you know, anecdotes about how this experience works for people. So I think going through that process was a struggle, definitely, but it felt like, well, maybe if we think through this clearly enough, then it could eventually help people.
Carrie, is that something that you thought about initially? I mean, here's somebody who's living fairly close in your neighborhood. You know, sort of what would be the ground rules and how explicit you felt you might need to be in order to make the thing work, to make the relationship work?
I think in the beginning, we felt like we had to make a lot of rules and that we needed to have clear boundaries. But as we got closer with Rick, it was just like he was a close friend, and we didn't feel any threat that he was going to try to be a third parent at all. So our relationship evolved, and he's involved in our children's lives.
How did things change for you, Rick, after the children were born, when you saw your first child, essentially?
I mean, that's a pretty big shift because it stops being hypothetical and it's like these real considerations. I think initially I was pretty scared of Logan. Logan's the older of the two kids. And I just it seemed like there was a lot of potential for my interactions with her to be misread by whoever or, you know, could. So I wanted to keep my distance at first. And then just because, you know, throughout the years of making the film, we were periodically interviewing each other and having lots of explicit conversations about the relationship, that made it a little bit easier to just say, like, Logan kind of scares me, and then be able to kind of deal
well,
with
I was going to ask you if you were explicit about that with Mel and Carrie and saying, look, I'm feeling kind of strange about this. I'm feeling a little paternal, but I know I don't have that role. Help me out here.
As much as I could, yeah. I mean, normally we would hang out and I would have my camera and we'd shoot some video, and then I'd go back home, and on my way home I'd have all these thoughts, and then I'd send them a long email like the next day and say, these are the things that are on my mind, and try to like lay all that stuff out.
How did you and Mel work with that, Carrie, fear that Rick had about sort of where his boundaries were?
You know, we felt really, I guess, sympathetic to his situation because we knew he's a kind person and that he wasn't going to overstep his bounds. And we appreciated how he was being honest. And, you know, we just really encouraged him to try to lower the anxiety level, take the pressure off of himself, because it was really going to be okay.
How did you see his bounds? Where were his boundaries, did you think?
Well, really just as a close friend of our family.
How did making the film, I'll start with you, Carrie, and then I'll ask you too, Rick. How did making the film affect your relationship? Did it interfere in any way? Did it strengthen it?
It definitely strengthened our relationship. I mean, as Rick said, we only seen each other maybe 5 times before he became our donor. But the process of making the documentary, he would be at our home filming for hours and hours, and we would have very intimate conversations. And so that brought us really close.
And what about you, Rick?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you probably know this, interviewing people is kind of an excuse to have a more intense conversation than you would casually. So I think that without the film, I could have easily just ignored some of the fears that I was having and not addressed them. But the film sort of forced me to do it, whether it was easy to do or not.
Well, the other thing it forces you to do is be more critical in your thinking about what it is, and actually gives you permission to be a critical thinker about something that we think should only be kind of an emotional experience, right?
Yeah.
So you get to be a little more analytical about it. You even had an intense conversation with yourself one night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's sort of a It's a moment I call the sad Rick scene in the movie. I just, you know, there was a point where my, you know, being a donor, my making a film about being a donor was, it came up as an issue in my marriage at the time. And so I was sort of grappling with that of what, you know, where my priorities are, like, how do I kind of untangle all of this stuff that seems sort of all wrapped up together. And so, yeah, I sort of took a page out of Ross McElwee's book, because watching Sherman's March was like pretty instrumental in being a documentary filmmaker. So I thought, like, well, maybe there's something here, you know, so I turned my camera on and sort of talked through some of those things. And I didn't show that. I didn't watch it myself or show it to anybody for about a year, and then remembered that it existed. And then that ended up becoming part of the film.
Carrie, you carried your first child, Logan.
Yes.
And then Mel carried your second child, Dylan. Mm-hmm. And of course, we live in a state where you're not permitted to be married.
Right.
And therefore, the adoption of your children is second party adoption is also not legal in this state. Tell us how you've managed all that and what that's done.
Well, originally when I had Logan, we were permitted to adopt. Mel was permitted to adopt Logan. And then sometime later, the state Supreme Court took that away.
It was 2010, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, thank you. And that was devastating for us. And, I mean, the plan had been that she would adopt Logan and I would adopt Dylan. But by the time Dylan was born, I didn't have that option. So we just drew up paperwork where, you know, I can sign off on health documents for Dylan and she can for Logan. But there's really a limit to the legal protections for our family.
This is an interesting situation where each of you carried one of your two children. And we think about these maternal instincts and maternal attachments as being somewhat different than the other parental attachment. Did you feel that with your second child? And did Mel feel it with your first child, the child that you bore, a difference in attachment?
You know, we did. And that's one of the conversations that it was a real intimate conversation that I wouldn't have had with just anybody. One of those that Rick referred to as being part of an interview. And we felt, I guess we felt like we should share it because there was a difference. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand it at first because I was the one who carried Logan. And mm-hmm. I could recognize it in Mel and how she was interacting with Logan. I could tell that she loved Logan, but that she didn't have that like really concrete bond that I had. And so I tried to keep that in the back of my mind when it was Mel's turn to be pregnant, that I might feel the same way. And even though that was in the back of my mind, when Dylan was born, I remember feeling like this guilt or shame about not having that same solid connection that I did with Logan. So we put that out there in the documentary just because we felt like, you know, I'm not going to say that everybody's going to feel the same way, but if you do, you have permission to feel that way. I had to give myself permission to feel that way.
Such a unique perspective and courageous of you to have that conversation out loud, because I, as the father of my two children, I'm sure don't feel the same about them as my wife. And I'm never obligated to feel guilt about that. Right?
Yeah.
So for you to be in this situation, this unique situation, to give us that perspective and then be honest enough to talk about it, I think is absolutely admirable. It's an incredible thing.
Thank you.
Rick, in the process of making this film, again, all of these families coming together, you went through a divorce.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, that sort of put the film on hold for a little bit. But yeah, in the process of all of that, I did end up getting divorced. And that was, you know, then it became this question of how much am I going to include this in this other story? And I tried for a long time to convince myself that they were completely separate. And because for fear that people would just conflate them as one complete thing. And then I eventually sort of found a way to have both conversations and hopefully address that in the film in some way.
It's great. And open, honest conversation about family. It's difficult for all families to live and navigate in this state. It is less family friendly than some other states, but maybe we'll see how that changes through as it makes its way through the courts. But let me ask you, Carrie, how you talk to your kids about Rick?
Well, we have talked with Logan. She's the older one. She's 4 and a half. We've told her that Rick is her donor in, you know, 4-year-old terms. And Dylan doesn't know yet. But whenever we spend time with Rick, she's always excited to see him. And we had the conversation by talking about this book that's called Ntango Makes Three. And it's these penguins and a zookeeper. It's two male penguins who want to have a baby, and the zookeeper gives them an egg. And so that's how we told Logan about it. We said, you know, Rick is really special to us because he helped us make you. And she, of course, asked why. And we explained two girls can't have a baby, just like two boys can't have a baby. But Rick was like the zookeeper for us in the Tango book. He was able to give us what we needed. And she said, okay, can I have some more pancakes?
Great project, great story. Thank you both for being on the program. Carrie Downey Piper is a clinical social worker and one of the mothers of two children, Logan and Dylan. Rick Dilwood's a filmmaker and a film professor at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks.
Thank you.
There's more of The State of Things just ahead. We'll talk about financial literacy and children. Stay tuned.